Is this a Netflix thing?
It's actually a podcast.
What the fuck's a podcast?
You know, it's kind of like a radio show.
Call that radio.
Yeah.
She called that radio. We're live. And unless you're listening to the audio podcast, then we're not live. But we have a special guest. We have, I think, maybe this is our fifth season. I think every season we've had Darren on. Orwell Prize winner, BAFTA winning television star, and as of 2 hours ago, a SAMA nominated hip hop artist. It's Darren McGarvey. How's it going, mate?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right, mate. I'm all right. It's just busy. It's getting a book finished. So I've just finished listening to your book finally. I started ages ago, but it's been a bit of a traumatic year. So I was like, I'll maybe wait till it's a better time.
But yeah.
What could be a better time than listening to you talking about how a book destroyed your life as I'm trying to sort of switch off? Because I like putting an audiobook or a podcast on it, just sort of drift off to sometimes. But yeah, it didn't help with the insomnia at all, man. That was a lot. Well done. It's a powerful thing.
Thank you, mate. I appreciate that. I mean, it's interesting what people take from the book. If you've took that a book destroyed my life, then that's the beginning of a journey for you.
What my takeaway was, but it was more like that bit made my ears prick up because I'm just finished about it. I went, right, two reasons. One, it's rude to not have listened or read your book before you come on the show. Even Nicola Sturgeon read your book before she interviewed you, you know. So if Sturgeon's got time. And then when I heard about it, I was like, this is maybe really important information before I actually send off my book to publisher. There might be some golden nuggets in there, and there certainly was. So yeah, I took a lot away from it, man. I think I've diagnosed myself with the victim mentality. I think I've got the beginning of the victim mentality. I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that a wee bit. And I think it comes.
That's really interesting, man. That you say that.
Yeah, not like in a pure, not in an extreme way, but I feel like I was, I didn't know what it was, but I feel like I was maybe subconsciously aware of it because I just felt a wee bit let down and disappointed in people, I suppose.
Mm.
And I think what I was aware of is that I'm projecting my standards to other people. And so what I've kind of done is like, I've just sort of backed away. In fact, I've backed away a lot. I've went rural. I've just left.
You've done a geographical, mate.
I've left the island, all the people. But yeah, am I reading that right? What you're talking about? Because obviously you're talking about the sort of it goes on to different extremes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's in the kind of third part of the book. So there's a lot of like establishing certain concepts in order for that part of the book to be slightly more palatable than it might be if you were just coming out with that in the first part. So obviously first part of the book outlines a kind of cultural critique of the trauma industry and the trauma discourse, whether you're talking about charities, platform people with trauma, or you're talking about social media influencers who either disclose publicly their trauma or mental health professionals of varying ability and agenda, really kind of offering the magic pill for managing your trauma. And then the second part of the book tells a story, you know, shows the power of a lived experience story, but then begins to deconstruct it, you know. So it's like taking the pre-established form of a lived experience person talking about their trauma, but then imagine that person stayed on stage for another 15 minutes and went, actually, let's run a fine tooth comb through all of that story I just told you. And so the chapter you're talking about where it refers to victimhood is ultimately like it's a kind of call to arms rather than a criticism. And it's me outlining the ways, particularly during my drinking days, where I descended into a kind of permanent victim mentality. And on the front, it never seemed like that. I would have came across maybe as a rebellious activist or somebody who had convictions. But underneath, a lot of what was driving it was a sense of feeling excluded, a sense of feeling like I had been forgotten about. And it all come from childhood, you know, the struggle to be heard. And, you know, by outlining it in the way that I do in the book, I'm trying to encourage the reader to go, on that journey as well if they need it. And victimhood manifests in different ways. I think most people will experience a justified sense of victimhood at some point in their life when a wrong has been done to them, whether it's an interpersonal thing or a systemic thing. But ultimately, whatever happens to us, we are the ones that unfortunately are responsible for cleaning up most of the mess. And that means eventually not just being able to describe what happened, but also being able to describe how it changed us for good and for bad. And for bad, for some of us, it can be victim mentality, a victim mindset, or it can become like a victim mentality, which is more pathological. And we know people like that, that they become almost impossible to have a relationship with unless you're constantly co-signing their very paranoid, delusional way of looking at everything.
Okay, it's in one hand, I'm like, because I do know people like that, and in one hand, I'm like, how can it get that bad? But in another way, I can kind of see how it can be intoxicating to just, you know, like, everything is always somebody else sort of thing. It must be quite hard to let go of that, because there's a freedom to that, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a freedom in basically... when that's the answer to every question, then you're not really called upon to do very much, but constantly have it reconfirmed that that is what is the case is now. But whatever freedom that gives you in short term, the long term is that people with a victim mentality, they will actually go around subconsciously burning every bridge to a better mindset, to a healthier lifestyle. Because the minute that anybody who gets close to them loves them enough to challenge them, then that will be taken as an attack. Because if you're immersed in a victim mentality, there's no constructive criticism. There's no nuance. And so, unfortunately, one of the negative impacts of the trauma industrial complex is that there's an algorithm for every mindset, including the victim mentality. And so the victim mentality algorithm, it will talk constantly about the systemic issues that you face as a result of your identity configuration. It will say, no, people don't have a right to tell you how to regulate your nervous system, because your nervous system's dysregulated as a result of, you know, late stage capitalism, systemic racism, systemic, you know, whatever it might be. And all of these things are true. But you will often find people who are just as, if not more, impacted by those things, who have a different mindset around it, and therefore they experience the world in a more even-handed way, even when it gets difficult. And it's a difficult thing with a victim mentality, because either the person has to really bottom out until they're kind of humbled to come back to reality, or they just continue on a path and they become surrounded by people who, you know, exploitative, or people who have similar mentalities, and so they all kind of validate each other in a culture where they're not really in touch with the truth of things.
Can you remember the tweet that you talked about? Because I had to go back, because I thought I was disagreeing you with that at one point, so I actually sat with that bit for a while. So it was something like the wounded healer. Okay, so it was a tweet that you didn't like, and it sounded on the surface like it was all right, but yeah, could you go into that?
Well, basically, this guy's very, very prominent social media influencer. He's a mental health professional, and he does a lot of good content. But I remember one day he did a tweet where basically the gist of the tweet was, he was basically encouraging people who were in the grip of a mental health crisis to start making character judgments about the people around them. He was implying that, you know, your risk of being exploited by people around you is increased by your vulnerability. And that is true. But the way that he framed it was that he framed it in a way that I thought lacked nuance, because something that was missing from his analysis was that often encouraging people who are in the grip of a mental health crisis to start assessing things like that, it's not always a safe bet. If you've ever walked alongside somebody who's in a mental health crisis, usually you know the first problem you've got is convincing them that they've got a problem, because they might be impaired in some ways, but in other ways they'll still be dead sharp. They'll be able to convince you there's nothing wrong. They'll be able to sometimes even convince you you're harming them by challenging them. And coming from a culture of alcoholism, whether at the household level, the cultural level or whatever. This is something I've always seen, and this is something I have exhibited myself. So
I was quite upset about hearing how bad you were doing, and I would have always challenged you if I'd thought you were, but you really were good at masking things. Like, it blows my mind.
Because
obviously there was quite a lot of this book where I'm actually there at some points, and I'm like, yeah. Wow, I had no idea. It was sort of mind blowing. I mean, you did a fucking TED talk. I was a plus one for a TED talk.
I did a TED talk, and I don't remember doing the TED talk. I freestyled it. So I remember.
You didn't seem bored. I suppose in hindsight, was that maybe were you something else?
Well, the thing is, when you've got a baseline competence, you can do most things. I mean, there's a lot of clips of me on YouTube and videos and stuff that's been uploaded by third sector organisations, mental health people, NHS. And like, if I look at the clip, I can tell you if I'm on painkillers or not, because I always get a really bloated stomach from codeine. So I remember one time I'm talking in the conferences, maybe like 300, 400 strong. Do you know, when you've got everybody eating at the palm of your hand, and there's a part of you that just wants to go, I'm fucked. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm actually fucked. But the thing about the book is that it's saying, if we're giving all people all this information about trauma, and we're talking about openness, and we're talking about being there for people, but a very, very prominent lived experience voice can basically just be a chameleon and camouflage themselves and pretend they're all right, while at the same time not being all right, then that really cuts to the assumption that every person who has a story to tell publicly does so for good reasons, that story is all true, and that story is safe to put out into the public domain. So part of the book is also just me cleaning up a bit of the mess that I made in my own life. And I think that while my circumstances are unique to me, people will see, the themes will echo for a lot of people in their own lives, irrespective of the level of public notability or whatever. You know, we all tell ourselves stories about our lives, and sometimes those stories aren't as true as they feel.
If you were to go back in time, if you could go back in time, obviously there's probably other things you'd go to do first, but on Poverty Safari alone, would you, if you had the option, would you change things that you put it in it to maybe cause you some controversy?
I wouldn't change. It's hard to say, because the way everything, that book was true to what everything felt to me at the time. Lally, see if you could just not run around like a rhinoceros, that'd be great. Thank you.
Lily,
that'd be great.
Can't hear Lily.
It's hard, you know, as well as a creative person. You know, you go back and listen to your early releases, and you the first thing you'll notice is the things about the thing that no longer chime with how you feel about stuff now, or even just changes in the way that you express yourself, or different tastes that you had. And it's a bit like that with books, especially if there's an element of memoir. They're more like a kind of photograph of how you were at a certain time. But I just, when I wrote my first book, I had no idea it would become like an international thing, you know. So you can never assume that. You would never plan for that. And so really what happened to me was it set me on this mad journey of being like public, and then having a sense of not necessarily regret, but a sense of the consequences of being as personal as I was, because not only was I putting information out there, but I was establishing a relationship with readers that was basically, you come to me for this kind of stuff. And so what I found later, when I tried to move in directions that were maybe a bit less personal, whether it was other books or whether it was even, you know, people wanting to turn aspects of my life into like drama for television and all of that, whenever I would go and meet them and try to pitch them something different, you could sense the lack of interest. You know what I mean? What they wanted was Poverty Safari, Peaky Blinders style, do you know what I mean? And I just felt that was, it would have been too hard on my family, and it would have been too, they would have focused too much on the graphic detail of certain incidents and maybe missed a lot of the context that the book's fuller. Do you know what I mean? It's fuller, it's rich with context, but media people, I think sometimes they don't sense that stuff. And so what you get is violence and depictions of people taking drugs and bevy and all that sort of stuff.
Cartoon characters.
Right, exactly. And I think some of the people who approached me back then, you know, they have a record for doing stuff pretty well and doing stuff pretty tastefully, but also they have a record for doing stuff that's mostly fiction. I've no saw stuff that's actually drawn from autobiography. And I think that I can imagine that being a painful process if you're the person who's lived it and then you're watching the thing getting changed in order to fit another medium and go for a big audience. So luckily I never went forward with those things. Do you know what I mean?
It's a much wider audience if you're going to have a TV show as well, isn't it? So it's just...
Yeah. Well, I always feel if there's going to be something on the telly that's got elements of my life in it and I kind of in the style of a drama or something, then I would like to be involved with writing it, you know, and learn about how to write for that style of television. I don't just want to sign over the rights and then just watch a bunch of middle class people doing it. You know what I mean?
Well, American guys doing Scottish accents.
Exactly.
A thing that was quite new. Well, it's actually not. The book's not the first time, but it's in recent time, which I was really interested about, was EMDR, which I'd actually never heard about until maybe about 6 months ago. I remember you. I think you maybe did a podcast, or you became the spokesman of EMDR. Am I saying that right? Sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but it's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. So it's a therapy that was basically kind of chanced upon by a psychologist who one day went out for a walk when she was feeling a bit disturbed, and she was watching some leaves blowing about on a path, and as her eyes were going from left to right, she noticed that her level of disturbance went down a wee bit. So she just had the kind of like epiphany of doing a bit more research into what might cause that. And then so it advanced to different levels of trials and eventually they did discover that there was a link between what they call bilateral stimulation, which is basically any kind of movement of symmetry in the body, you know, looking left to right, or maybe tapping your fingers or having a therapist tap your fingers. And when you get someone into that state, you can speak to, you basically can make suggestion to their subconscious. So a therapist can basically help you revisit traumatic events, and in doing so and reframing them in a more positive way, they can move them from your immediate memory, which is where a lot of trauma is stored and that's how you get triggered, to your long-term memory, where the memory is still there, but it can't be activated in a way that's as painful as an emotional trigger. And so EMDR, I was like one of the first people to get it. In Scotland back in 2002 or 2003, and it worked a treat for me. And then my treatment stopped quite abruptly because I kind of aged out, but I still have a relationship with the therapist who did it, and it was her that suggested the EMDR ambassador role, because her husband, also a psychologist who was one of the first responders to the Dunblane shooting, so he's a specialist in trauma, he thought he'd chance his arm and get his wife to ask me, since she knew me. And I thought, aye, I'm up for it. It'll be cool. So I'll link up with them every now and then and try to promote EMDR, because it's not for everyone. Like, no therapy is, you know, but a lot of people don't know about it. And because there's a kind of mystical element to it, where they're not quite sure what it is, you know, in terms of the mechanics.
It's just not bad, though, because the first time, as soon as I heard about it, because I don't think I'd ever actually heard it before. So I just... The first thing I do when I hear a new thing is write debunked after it, and then work my way back from there. And there's quite a lot of positive stuff about it as well. Do you know what I mean? It's not going to be for everyone, as you said, not a one size fits all. But it was really interesting. It was great to hear the warmth and reverence you had for that woman.
She came along when I was maybe about 19. And it was really the first time, I think, in my life that I had somebody who was really only interested in hearing my perspective on all the things that had been going on in my life, you know what I mean? Because usually when you're in a family and there's a lot of adversity, especially a family where everyone's wounded, everyone's really fighting to be heard over everyone else, so no one's listening to anyone else, and then the battle becomes about who can dominate that kind of toxicity. But when you're sitting across from a therapist and they're really just interested in you, then you suddenly feel a sense of relief for the pain just in some of the stuff that you've experienced, just being witnessed by somebody else rather than somebody trying to defend themselves or dismiss what's happened. Somebody just going, oh, wow, man, that must have been hard. And that's a big part of recovering from trauma, is just someone attuning to you emotionally. You know, whether you're right or wrong, or whether you've got some details wrong, or none of that matters in the beginning. You need to be met wherever you are, and for someone to have a real curiosity about how you've interpreted things and the sort of impact that's had on you mentally and physically. And she provided that for me in a way that I would say saved my bacon back then, because it was only a couple of years after that then drink became the solution for me, you know what I mean? But I think if I hadn't had some of that work done prior to taking up the drinking when I moved into a flat by myself, then I think some of my behaviour on the drink might have been a bit more dangerous for me, for other people. But there was a kind of core resilience through that therapy that I think carried me through some difficult times.
And as you point out, that wouldn't happen these days, would it? If a 17-year-old like yourself in a similar situation went to try and get some help?
Yeah, because they would need to wait 6 months to a year. And also just that process now, I think now people have lost faith in the idea of even picking up the phone and asking for help. You know, I mean, we all know even just how many of us will sit with something that feels like a doctor could sort it out in a couple of days, and we just kind of wait it out because we think, I can't be bothered talking to the receptionist and having to kind of plead my case, or I can't be bothered sitting and having to phone 100 times before somebody picks up. I'll go to the chemist, I'll get what I can get for there and just plod on. And that's all right if all you've got is a cold or a wee infection. But when it comes to a mental health issue, particularly with the varying quality of information that's available freely online, when it comes to mental health, most people tend to gravitate towards whatever feels good or whatever feels right. And what feels right is whatever validates them initially. Now, that's all right in a therapeutic context, but when you're by yourself, just on a journey and a wormhole online, just seeking validation, it takes you down some rabbit holes that will actually prolong a lot of your pain. You'll misdiagnose yourself, you'll misdiagnose relational dynamics, and you'll misdiagnose people in your life who actually challenge you in ways that are healthy. Because they challenge you and you don't like it, you'll label them in different ways. And that's why you need a therapeutic guidance to sort of help you navigate through that buffet. Because people, as you know, if they walk into a buffet, they walk straight to the junk food, you know what I mean? And it's the same way information about health, whether it's fitness, whether it's diet, or in this case, trauma.
And that's sort of similar why everybody's ex is a narcissist now and stuff like that.
Everybody. Yeah. It's just an easier story to tell yourself, isn't it? The reason you didn't get along with the person is because they have a pathological mental health condition, because otherwise, why would they think you were an arsehole? Do you know what I mean?
There's obviously, I don't want to spoilers. I'm not going to do spoilers, so I don't want to. Obviously, your feelings towards the trauma are so complex. It is complex, and it's you go through various ways of talking about it. But would you say that your views softened on it in general? Because I got feeling that there was a quite an interesting bit where you said that when you were talking to specialists that you do have had respect for and stuff, when you were trying to get them to kind of, back up your initial thoughts. Sorry, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right, mate. I started off like a lot of my stuff kind of coming from a place of irritation. You know, I think a lot of my best writing starts there, but it goes through a process of softening and going for a bit more not nuance. And just kind of ironically, what happened to me was, you know, halfway through the process, I experienced some adversity. And so then I was experiencing like different effects of trauma being kind of awakened by certain circumstances. And so first of all, that gave me a kind of like, that was like a, once I started to kind of get myself together, it reminded me that I can't assume what the level of trauma is of the reader or what the experience is of the reader, and that I need to actually tread a lot more delicately through this terrain in terms of what the tone of the book is, because there's a lot of passages in the book that were written for humour. And while that stuff still works in a live context with audience that's familiar with you, a lot of people come to your book cold, they don't know you, someone's bought them the book, and they're just reading it, and so you need to be careful. So I sought a lot of guidance from mental health professionals in terms of letting them get proof copies and stuff to give me feedback. I let every single contributor to the book that I feature read the entire chapter that they're featured in, so that they can, first of all, okay everything. And that was a really useful part of the process as well. But also, when I met with certain campaigners or people with, you know, a bit of professional background in this, I think that they could sense I was on a journey with it. And part of the thing that brought me back to a place of reasonableness in terms of the tone was just that they knew me well enough to sort of give me my place. They understood where my frustrations were coming from. A lot of how I approached this book was informed by my experience of the online world. And so actually it was really, I think it was a prudent decision for me to engage the public for a year before I finished the book, because that really informed, sometimes you write a book, you lock yourself away, you come up with the answers on your own, and then you just stand behind it when it goes out. But this process that I decided to do, where I'm reading chapters out in universities, drafts, and I'm getting a sense in the room of how does it feel to say these things when there's instant consequences, you know? And I think that that led to a book that might not have been the sort of instant bestseller catnip that a more annoyed and Piers Morgan-esque type book might have been. But I think in the long run, it'll find its audience and it'll have real legs. And that's a good thing.
And you mentioned the bit, you ran up the chapters by everyone. I'm not going to say his name, but I remember his name. Let's talk about the bit where Eminem has a direct influence on you sticking up for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you didn't run it by Scott or whatever he's called. Or is that a real name?
He's a good guy. He went on to become like a cage fighter, and I can't take credit for that. He went on to become like a cage fighter, so he's like clued up on the martial arts space. And I've chatted to him a few times over the years. He's somebody for school that kind of has kept tabs on what I'm up to, and has always been very nice. That's a memorable moment from my childhood.
I think it was just to clarify, I didn't call you a fanny. I said something like acting like a fanny.
No, it's fine.
I had a yellow ball. So bring it on.
We were all fannies back then in different ways. But no, the situation was basically like that up until I started listening to hip hop, then I was less likely to engage in conflict. You know what I mean? Like my mother had forced me to do it a lot of the time, and I was, so if I did do it, it was to get her approval, but she was long gone by then. And then I started listening to hip hop, and then obviously when I discovered Eminem, bullying was a big theme in his music, and I had always gravitated in terms of culture towards characters that were brave, you know, like that were that could stand up to people, because I had the fantasy, you know what I mean, of being strong and being able to handle myself. And I think with Eminem, then it was just, he was literally just explaining his experience, and it was just something about the music and how it made me feel. It was just like an adult giving you a kind of stern talking to, but not just saying, you need to go out there and fight, and basically threatening you with shame. It was somebody going into the mindset, you know, the switch where you just go for, you know what, I've fucking had enough of this shit. And then you just decide to fight back. And that was a kind of turning point for me, because as much as that was a good moment in terms of my development, it was also the genesis of a new narrative where I start identifying very strongly with a lot of the themes and plot points of Eminem's story. And so then I begin to emphasise certain things about my experience and de-emphasise others, including the relationship with my mother, and the dysfunction, and you know, growing up in a working class community, and so it's like, it's not that that stuff wasn't true, but I started dialing that up when I got into the hip hop scene, and then you pour alcohol and drugs into that, and the hang is, in the hip hop scene, everyone bought into Loki very quickly, you know what I mean? So it became kind of harder for me to be more authentic a lot of the time, because it was like, no one's interested. And the other stuff, you know what I mean, or at least I thought that. Obviously, as the music developed, and then I start writing songs like Across the Room, where you start to get a sense of another part of me that's coming through. But for a while, I just felt that I was not even playing up to it in a conscious way. I enjoyed the power, the feeling of power. I enjoyed the feeling of being powerful, the feeling of being feared, the feeling of being known as somebody who's not running for conflict, but somebody who's out looking for you. Because that wasn't my experience as a kid, you know.
I think I would argue though that your early stuff was authentic for who you were at the time.
Because, oh, of course.
Because you were the battle rapper. You were aggressive. You were drinking and doing stuff. So I think it was, obviously it's like everything that's a slightly exaggerated at times, but yeah, the early stuff was amazing. We should actually give a shout out. The album, not funded by Creative Scotland, is out on Friday.
Yeah, it is indeed. I just managed to get a few. You know what it's like with these online distributors now, man? It's like a back and forth for days and days on the most stupid things. But luckily, it was all just related to format and stuff and nothing to do with music. So uncleared samples have managed to get through the algorithm, and also technically a kind of copyrighted image has managed to get through as well. So that's out on Friday, and I think that'll go good with the Sama stuff, having that stuff out streaming.
It's a brilliant time for that to come out, absolutely.
I'm going to get some clips done with Andrew as well, so we'll have some visual stuff happening. No music videos, too much money, too much time. Yeah. I'm just going to do some clips for socials, do you know what I mean? And that's it.
That's what I've ended up doing. Well, we did a great video. Shouts to Martin Mindybank. He did a one for a fancy man right about the album launch time. And then we had an old
that's
one.
That's a good man.
I feel at the end was originally came out about 2 years ago, so that's on the album as well. But yeah, I just found that just, you know, because if you could just do a wee clip, and some of the clips, they're just miming the camera or walking by with the lyrics coming up, and
it's almost as if you're going to do a music video now, you need to make it more than that. You need to make it like a short film or a mini doc or something that because just the idea of just people devoting 3.5 minutes of their time to just watching you visually do the song that they can just go and listen to. Anytime
what
we want, it's not get the same pool.
What's happened to people's brains, man?
Because I mean, I'm not that fussed because filming music videos, it's my least enjoyable part of the process. I just don't like it. I've never liked it.
Yeah.
I don't like being outside. I don't like stoning about. Do you know what I mean? Like, I want to know where the toilet is. I want to be in a warm environment. You know what I mean? So I'll get Andrew McKenzie up and we'll do some stuff out in the room in the studio. We've got a studio out in the garden there, and we'll just get creative out there in terms of how we make it look cool, you know what I mean?
Amazing. And we got Lindsay said EMDR using a row of lights, the results were incredible, especially because it sounded daft at first. The process wasn't easy though.
No, it's not easy, and a lot of people kind of can confuse it as if it's a sort of hypnosis, but it's got a bit more scientific backing than that. The EMDR, as I say, partly it's to do with the therapeutic relationship, right? So that's why somebody saying that they're EMDR trained because they did a weekend course, they're not trained and they're not safe to do it with, because you're working with trauma that's basically, you're trying to, it's like plugging in a flash drive. You're trying to move a file from the laptop on a hard long-term storage, right? If you're just working with a two-bit cowboy therapist, that file can get damaged, that file can get stuck. And so there's protocols involved with EMDR that are all about making sure that you've established a conceptual vision of a safe place for the person so that you can go there if something becomes too disturbing. But people who train for 2 days say they're EMDR qualified. This is one of the many reasons why you need to be very diligent if you're trying to find any kind of support or anything like that online. It's not for everybody, like I say, but part of also the, I believe, and this is just my own kind of conjecture, that, you know, in medicine, we have the placebo effect, right, which is evidence of the power of human belief, right? So the placebo effect can account for someone given basically a sugar tablet and then their headache going away because they think they've taken a painkiller. And I think when it comes to any mental health modality, then if you're invested at a deep level, I think that that similar effect would increase the likelihood that it would work. So if you go in skeptical, the chances are there'll be resistance. But if you go in wholeheartedly, you have a good therapist and you really commit to the process, then I don't see how it can do any harm.
Yeah, well, the good therapist is, because at the end of the day, even if it is a placebo, you're still engaging with a therapist on a higher level than you would be if you were just talking. And also the tapping thing's been proved. I've heard that for years, you know, it goes along with things like, you know, find a smell, find a sight. Do you know what I'm talking about, that one?
Yeah, and these are just kind of grounding techniques a lot of the time as well, and they're about bringing your awareness to something other than the narrative in your head, which is where a lot of the pain lies for us, irrespective of what happened. You know, there's the physical or psychological reality of what happened, but then there's the story that we tell about what the person's intentions were. You know, I always use the example of, like, if I'm walking into a room that you're in, Mark, and I open the door and I hit you, the door, the physical impact of the door hitting you hurts, but you know it was an accident. But if I walk into the door and I hit you and then I laugh and you feel that I meant to hit you, then the impact physically is still the same, but there's a psychological wound because you're like, what the fuck was that all about? Do you know what I mean? And so the more serious the trauma, the more potential there is for us to go down these wormholes and speculate as to what the motives and culpability of other people were. And sometimes a lot of pain lies there long term. And a therapist can help us to take out the stuff we don't need or the stuff we can never know and reframe it in a way where we can begin to re-educate our nervous system that most of the time we're safe. And that when there's things in the environment that remind us of a traumatic event, usually that's just the trauma and we're not unsafe, but it takes a long time. And like I say, you need to be really committed to it. And a lot of people, sadly, their baseline is trauma. They've never looked at it. So they think that that's how life feels. And that's the saddest thing. You know, if you ask them, how do you get on in life? What are you up to? What they'll describe as a bunch of coping strategies that they've confused with a personality or personal preferences. Their whole life is built around keeping themselves comfortable, and they're very resistant to doing anything that pushes beyond those boundaries because it's so hard, you know what I mean?
And what's a way to regulate your nervous system in general? Is exercise, breathing's good. Who would have thought? Remember to breathe. Yeah. That's a good one as well. But is there any steps that you take to try and keep on top of that?
Yeah, I mean, if something disturbs me, I mean, I've had maybe 6 months of a pretty good stability in terms of just for me, part of it was recognizing that when I felt a level of disturbance, sometimes there was behaviours that I would then engage in that I felt were necessary, but actually make it worse. And so paradoxically, as much as sometimes the trauma is not caused by you, you actually make it worse for yourself in terms of how you respond to certain discomfort. So for me, that might have been forgetting to eat, you know, or staying up very late, or conducting my own kind of behaviors where I think I'm keeping myself safe by trying to stay abreast of all these different types of things, when actually I'm just exhausting myself and banging my head against a wall. And then also in terms of just like physically, it's like what I realize is that when the feeling happens, what then happens is the mind comes in and starts telling your story about why you've got that feeling. But actually that story usually is some version of a story that you've been telling yourself since you were a kid, but it just changes based on the context. But the root subtext of it's always the same. So for me, it would usually just be, you can't trust anybody. You know, nobody's safe. I'm going to get hurt. And so whatever the narrative was, that you start to try to get into the habit of feeling the traumatic things kind of stirring up a wee bit, noticing the brain, and then just breathing through it, you know, or getting yourself busy doing something else. And actually, kind of strangely, as much as a lot of the guidance that people get online is that if you feel triggered or you're at risk of being triggered, you need to move away from it and be in not expose yourself to it. Actually, the trick is to lean into the thing and breathe through the thing when you're ready, because that's what teaches your body that anytime you get that wee twinge of paranoia or anxiety or pain, that you don't need to let it rob you of your entire day or week or sometimes month, you know?
That's it. I've actually just remembered that I heard someone else talking about something similar, and I've just remembered that one of the things is like moving your eyes up and down or something, which actually ties in with that EMDR thing. So I think it's just like a reset, it's just a physical reset or something like that as well.
It does.
But you mentioned trigger warnings, so I always like when we get back to trigger warnings. And it's because you're talking about, is it Blue Bag Life, the premiere?
Yeah.
And there was a trigger warning before the Q&A and stuff like that. And I think it was good listening to that, because obviously, you know, I had a lot of trauma. There were certain things that I suppose trigger warning wasn't a thing. So I had my own certain things that would kind of make me wince a bit. Wince. Mm-hmm. I kind of pretty much got over it by just mm-hmm. like going into it, just not, you know, just being prepared for it.
That's anecdotal to me.
It's definitely, it could have been an actual thing that could have really been a thing that I'd had to avoid all the time, like getting into, you know, an actual phobia or something of something mm-hmm. that you couldn't see. But not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. Angela says, lean into it. Go for it, Angie. So this is your first Fringe show that I've actually not seen, because I was all over the place with my traveling the world in a moon boot, couchsurfing in a moon boot. So I was, mm-hmm. but so I missed the show. So I'm buzzing to see it. It's the Glasgow version. So for anyone, it was a Fringe show, a critically acclaimed Fringe show in August, and you're bringing it to Glasgow on Sunday, November 23rd. You've chosen the venue, Ivory Blacks, because Kelvin gave you your first shot in a microphone. And
the album launch went so well last year as well, you know, so it just made sense to go back there. And I like the intimacy of the venue, the familiarity, and just dealing with Kelvin and the staff there. It's just quite a bit easier and quite a bit more, I would say, pleasant than just rolling up at a venue where you've got no prior relationships with people and it's very kind of industry minded. Sometimes I'm just no into that shite. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get Kelvin. You just send him a text. He checks a calendar and it's done. And that's it.
Yeah.
There's no surprises with Kelvin. Aye. To Kelvin. And also we decided to do it, make an early start, just because we're all getting a bit older, and it seems to me like every time we do a Sunday gig now, the earlier you're on, the better. Like when we played the Barras for Soapy Fest, I was actually worried because we were on quite early. It was a bit earlier than what we were supposed to be scheduled. But mm-hmm. I think it actually went in our favour, because a lot of people, you know, if they've got work the next day or whatever, you can come out, watch the show, and you can be home by 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. And if you don't want to do that, I think Kelvin's just going to let us just play some tunes anyway, so maybe just stay in, see what the people can decide if they want to stay a bit longer. But
exactly. My plan is to kind of, you know, do. I've got Becky coming to do support, and she's doing a kind of stripped back acoustic set with some other musicians, and she's using it as an opportunity to kind of prepare for her tour that's coming up next year. So it seems like it would be a perfect environment for that, and given the themes of the show and the kind of vibe that I want to create, I think that sort of aesthetic will lend itself well to setting the scene and kind of setting the table. And then we'll have the 1 hour or so show. Obviously, we're having a bit extra time and not having that rapid fire turnaround at the fringe. I might have a wee bit more time to take the ball for a walk if the opportunity presents itself, but it's not going to be much longer than an hour. Then we'll break, then we'll come back for a 1 hour kind of Q&A engagement with the crowd. And then after, just have a kind of a sort of book signing, but also kind of debrief, decompressing, you know, an hour to chill and chat, because a lot of things come up for people with a show that is quite hard hitting. And unfortunately, the Fringe, there's not really the facility to have that deep, that sort of aftercare, if you will. So I thought, because it's a Glasgow show and a lot of people were on at me for not having a Glasgow show during the Fringe, I thought I'll give a Glasgow show and also I'll do a unique one-off format just for the troops, and hopefully that'll get people to come out and at that 5 p.m. you know, half four doors, 5 p.m. kickoff time. I think it gives people a bit of flexibility as well to get up the road and stuff, because I know that that's what I appreciate these days, having wee ones and stuff like that.
Absolutely, and it's a you don't normally like hanging about too long. I think you say that in your book about three times, or at least three times. I turned up just before my set, and I left just straight after it, kind of thing. So
especially so with the later on gigs or festivals and stuff like that. I don't mind so much, you know, if Becky's there or maybe one of the kids are with us, then we can make a wee event of it, you know what I mean? But if I'm on my own and it's late on, usually, you know, hanging about when everybody's just getting wild, I've just learned that it's no my scene. Obviously, I check in with people. I'm not a dick about it, do you know what I mean? I stop by and say hello to folk and catch up with people. But I think most people who know me understand that that's just the way I live my life now, you know?
Aye, of course. Andrew's asked for a ticket link. I put the ticket link in the comments. If you listen to the audio podcast, there'll be a link in the info. Marie says, any Irish dates yet?
We're working on it. I'm technically, I've not officially announced it yet. I'm planning to officially announce it at the event, but we're working on a bunch of dates for next year. And I want to get an Ireland date in there. I keep getting asked to come and do something, but unfortunately, somebody's got to book me or somebody's got to make themselves known for me to do that. I've obviously done events over there, but they've been more kind of sit-in conversation, typical book festival things. I've got a thing over in Belfast in December, which is more of a keynote kind of scenario, but it would be great. And then, you know, I think we're going to try and hit some places that I didn't hit in 2023. My whole hang is I just want to get back to the momentum that I had then, you know what I mean? I was making good decisions. Things were doing good. And then, you know, life happens and you get knocked off course a wee bit. So the idea of getting a tour together for next year is just to get back out there and try and make a habit of touring, and always keeping it simple. Do you know what I mean? It's really just me and my laptop, and that just makes it's Becky grabbing me up on the couch there.
Kind of went, we're just for people that maybe haven't seen the show yet, because we kind of just glossed over what the actual show is. So for anyone, what can people expect for the, because obviously some people know you as Loki the rapper, someone. People know you for your poetry background, your talking background. So what is Trauma and Racial Conflict?
It's a blend of all of these things where it really tries to echo the structure of the book in terms of taking the audience on a journey. But I would say that there's more humour in the show because we're a live audience in the room with you. You can take certain liberties tonally because there's a certain level of good faith and trust because you're in the room, but also it's more multimedia. It's multimedia in the way that Poverty Safari Live was. There's musical cues. There's I will rap certain bits in it. Some of it is comedy. Some of it is literally just feels like I'm doing a reading out of the book. So in terms of the actual form, it shifts and changes a bit, like, you know, a person's narrative about their own experience changes. But I think, I mean, Becky helped me a lot in terms of encouraging me to be a bit more ambitious with having certain videos displayed in the background and photographs. Sometimes it's getting kind of close to the wire. I'll revise down what my ambitions are because I need the simplicity in order to be able to kind of focus and get the thing over the line. But the sort of stuff that freaks me out, Becky can knock it together in a couple of hours, do you know what I mean? And then Conscious came in and provided some original ambient music for a certain quite hard-hitting part of the show. So I think that the show will take the audience on a journey in terms of, much like the book, it constantly gets the audience comfortable in a certain vibe and then pulls the rug and goes, ha-ha, that's not actually what's happening, troops. Do you know what I mean? And no matter how many times you do that, the audience is never quite used to it happening. It's always a surprise. And that sort of tries to reinforce the power of stories and how immersive they are, even if someone literally goes like that. Now, the story I'm about to tell you, some of it's true, some of it I've made up for effect, some of it subconsciously is maybe not as true as it feels to me. So just watch out for the bits. But then the minute you start talking, they're just like, ah, it's a cool story. Do you know what I mean? So if you can get your audience into that place where they're quite malleable, then they can have a really, they can have an amazing experience that kind of, for some of them, will feel like a bit of an exorcism if they're living with trauma or a story that's causing them pain because they see somebody else making it safe for them to examine their experience through new eyes. That's the theory, that's the hope. But the Fringe went well, and I didn't hear one complaint about the show. Usually if somebody has a complaint, they're quite vocal about it. So I would say it's probably the tightest show I've done yet, and that's what people who are always honest with their criticism have said to me as well, including Becky, and I believe them.
And there's obviously after the Fringe, so the Fringe went really well, and then you had sort of a book launch tour. At first I wasn't really sure what was going on, because it was Frankie Boyle and Mary Black and Nicola Sturgeon, and you were kind of, so were they, was it all those situations they're interviewing you, and how, what was that like?
I mean, it was, well, first of all, it was announcing it was quite a negative experience, actually. Obviously, it's people in London who are making the decisions or who are pitching the ideas to me. And all of those figures in London, in the London literary world, are just like no-brainers. Obviously, I've done stuff with Frankie before, but this is a cultural climate that's quite different. But what I realised was, there's no many public figures that you could partner up with that weren't they in some way seen as the worst people who ever existed by a small faction of terminally online people. And while I don't mean that in a dismissive way about some of the issues that people might have with some of the opinions of Sturgeon or Frankie or Mary, I realised actually, you know, it makes sense for me to do these events. It's generous of each of them to give up their time to support my work like that. That's them showing me a level of respect. And for me to get all caught up about getting called a prick 60 times a day for a week, you know, is kind of a symptomatic of maybe just being online a wee bit too much sometimes. The events were great. They were all packed to capacity. And each person had a totally different angle in terms of the interview, which meant that I had quite a pleasant experience each time. It wasn't in that repetitive way that it can get sometimes. And obviously, it was just cool to meet these folk. Obviously, I've met Frankie and Nicola previously, but it was just nice to kind of get a chat with them and stuff before the event. And it humanises people in a way sometimes that I think if you're online too much, you can forget.
We've got some comments. If you've got Angela's got her ticket, shouts Angela. Nice one.
Nice one, thanks.
Fringe, do you start getting obsessed with checking your daily ticket sales, or does somebody tell you what your daily ticket sales is?
I like the standard good, because they give you the link and you can just check all the information that you need. The information is important, because if you've got certain days that are quieter, you can target promotion for them. You can get specific graphics done or things cut in order to just pull attention to that. During the Fringe, typically, it's your kind of Wednesday and Thursday shows that will tend to be a bit quieter. But this year I had, I think this was one of my best runs. I got over 1,000 punters in over the 13 days. And that was without, I didn't have any kind of, I didn't pay a publicist or anything. There was no pluggers involved. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, if you invest in a plugger and you get that national media coverage, then you can double that. But the thing is, what you make doubling it goes to the plugger. If they're any good, they're hitting you for quite a considerable fee. You know what I mean? So I've always kind of found that actually the level that I'm at, as long as I'm constantly on it and making sure that all the bases are covered, then I can get more of a return and be in a simpler, smaller room. And so I do check the tickets daily, and there is a certain anxiety about it, and sometimes you do feel like it's a referendum on your personality. But the thing is that I've got to remember, the thing I've got to remember, Mark, is the sort of numbers that I would find disappointing are the sort of numbers most artists would be grateful to have turning up at a show. And it's amazing how quick you can forget that. Do you know what I mean? You're sitting at like 600, 700 tickets and you're in an existential crisis. And actually, if you've hit that, then you're already making a profit. And it's more the vanity.
Coming to a show, we'll be playing to 6 or 7 people at a show, if they're lucky.
It's exactly.
Fringe. Every single person who comes on the show says that they're never doing the Fringe again, and then they just do it. I think you said that this year, didn't you? You think you're maybe going to rethink it, but then you'll probably do it in the end.
And it's rethinking it in terms of the level of stress that's involved if you don't live there for your run. So see the travel back and forth every day, the day in a show, the trains. Luckily this year I think ScotRail were really on top of it all, and most days went off without much of a hitch, and that was great. But there is a certain mental labour that's involved where that you need to kind of recover from. So it's natural at the end of a run to feel a bit, even if it's gone well, you're a bit low and you're readjusting to civilian life after being in a bit of a bubble. So that's when you will hear people complaining and moaning or getting some stuff off their chest. But also there are some real issues that I'm lucky. I can afford the upfront costs associated with putting a show on. And because of the deal that I have with the Stand, I don't have to pay them upfront for hiring a venue. That all comes off the back end. So as long as I get enough punters in, then that's all covered, and I just get my settlement at the end. But there's all different types of deals and contracts that people can get involved in, where they have to pay for their accommodation, which is going to be a couple of grand minimum, and that'll be to live in a cupboard with a toilet in it. And then obviously there's the Fringe premium on top of the Edinburgh premium, which means your coffee, your water, everything that you could possibly buy, taxis, everything is much dearer than pretty much anywhere except London. So over the course of it, the running costs are just significant. And it just means that, it means when you're walking around there, you're getting a sense, you know, it's very middle class. It's a lot of privately educated artists, and that's fine. They do great work, and I don't mean to diss them when I say that. But in Scotland, we've got this thing where we like to trade on this idea that anybody can get a shot at things, and that we've got a commitment to social equality and social justice that maybe is lacking down south. When in practice, there's a lot of people I know that have dropped out because the risk is too great and the payoff is not big enough.
Yeah, it sounds a lot. Okay, I'm at the stage right now where I'm saying not to festivals next year. I'm saying I'm not doing any festivals next year at all. But it's only it's November now. Maybe I mean it this time.
Maybe you mean it, right?
We'll see. It's been great to listen to you, Darren, and I say good luck with the album launch and hoping to pick up a copy of your book soon. Sounds like a great laugh. Laughing along with the hoops and hurdles of young life with mental health insecurity and nice Angela's one. Living with trauma. Angela, it'll be good to see you out. See you at the gig. It'll be good. It'll be good to see you there, pal. Thanks for getting a ticket. And Dr. Ghostboy, hi guys. Interesting stuff. Keep on keeping on. Nice one. So aye, that's just about an hour anyway, Dan. Thank you very much for your time. And yeah,
oh, absolute pleasure.
Get to the Trauma Industrial Complex, Ivory Blacks, on the 23rd of November. Early start, 5 o'clock. 1 hour performance, 1 hour Q&A. Support from Becky Wallace and a wee meet and greet after it. Shelto Mills, if you're listening, you're going to get a ticket now. Brilliant, Mel. And the book is out. It's on audiobook as well. I got it. I listened to it on Spotify, The Bad Guys. I listened through. But go to a local bookshop if you can. And so we've got the album. So you've got this on the 23rd. You've got the album now on the Friday.
Drumming and streaming. I can say this. The streaming edition of the album has a different track list. It's a wee bit different. So obviously, if people want the full proper experience, then they still have to go to the Bandcamp and buy it. So I pulled a couple of tracks off. But actually, this version, much like the vinyl edition, it plays in a different way. It's a wee bit more to the point. And also, I've added Run To It, which is a song that was originally written for this album, released in along with Don't Jump in 2019. So the album opens differently. And also, I have added a track that I recorded with Superman on the beat, the track Things I Must Do. That's been added into the track list. So the album's still sitting about the same runtime, but it'll play a wee bit different. And I'm hoping that, you know, it'll be good for people coming in for the first time, as well as people who are familiar with it but maybe want a bit of a different experience. So that's dropping Friday.
And I'm assuming that the copyright image is not funded, but it's the Creative Scotland logo. But if they sue you, they're just, they know what the follow-up album's going to be. Sued by Creative Scotland.
No, they won't. I mean, obviously they know it's out there. But the thing is, I might know that, what, you know, once this kind of cycle's done and the thing's out and streaming and all that water's under the bridge, then, you know, as myself, Darren McGarvey, I'm not adverse to maybe going down a public funding route for a project and seeing what I can do when I'm not feeling that every penny counts quite as much as sometimes when you're funding your own stuff, you know, getting access to certain things that sometimes are just a wee bit beyond me because my skill set is kind of fixed to what it is. So who knows, you know what I mean? I'm sure if I got a funding application into them, then I have as much chance as anybody else of it being approved. I've always felt that they owed me some money, to be honest, Mark.
I think they do. 100%. And you mentioned Superman and the Beat. So before we go, you're up against him for the best hip-hop in the SAMA Awards.
Yeah, I know, man. And Cryptic as well. Like, they're homies. But the thing is, I mean, it's not a small community, it's a big community, but it's also a close-knit community. So it's rare for people who are nominated to not know some of the other people that are on it. But everybody's a good sport, you know what I mean? I'm just happy to get the nod because of all the work that I put into the record. You know, it'll be a nice wee night out for the troops as well. I'll probably get some of the boys out and they can come and make an absolute nuisance of themselves in a formal music industry environment.
You'd rather just be rapping anyway, wouldn't you? You've said that before.
Aye, it would be much simpler if I could just rap.
All this nonsense you have to do just to make a hip-hop album. So it's a well-deserved nod. It's a cracking album. Not funded by Creative Scotland. Go and stream it on Friday. Or if you can't wait till Friday, go and buy it in Bandcamp now and go and check it out. Yeah. So final comment we got. It's such a great record. The album cover's one of my favourites. So iconic. It says, Catalo Disco. Cheers.
Thank you, man. Shout out to the Notorious Gasoline Company on that.
Patreon.com/ you call that radio if you want to support the show. And I'll see you Ivory Black Star on the 20th of November. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Take it easy, Dan.
Ciao.
See you later.